Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I am so glad you're with me today. I have an amazing show lined up. We have Heiko Schmidt joining us. He is an icon in the music industry, especially in Germany. He built a big music production company, and he ended up being in the 7-year lawsuit with BMG and EMI, and he found tax accounting fraud and fraud in general, which resulted in 2/3 more income for the artists and producers in the world for international music. Still some problems today going on in that industry, but his work resulted in changes to laws in Germany, and they created an application where artists and producers were able to recoup up to 70 times their income and reduce the fraud and waste in that industry. Very interesting, especially if you're an artist or producer in that industry. Listening to his story is really amazing. But since then, he's an entrepreneur at heart, and so he's always on the forefront of what's going on. He has a medical AI company that does face recognition for finding diseases. And they're able to find the disease based on your facial features well before you have symptoms. And he's going to talk about that and how that technology can be used in many different fields and how it's going to fundamentally change many industries. So he's going to talk about that. And then we're going to get into AI and how AI and medicine is, and data for yourself is a Wild West situation in the world, especially in the United States. And he sits on an AI board overlooking how we can do international laws for AI to keep it in the light side. We all know that AI can turn into a light, dark kind of situation, just like every other technology can be used in a light, very positive, move humanity in a wonderful direction, and it can also be used in a dark way to really take advantage of people. So having someone like him, who has focused much of his career on fixing fraud and issues and really taking care of the little people, the artists, the producers, people who are really doing and producing work, and finding ways to take care of them and eliminate fraud, having someone like him being out there in the forefront on these panels trying to establish laws is really great. So I recommend, if you are interested in that, you want to listen to this whole show. But before we get into that, I want to remind you about my Patreon account and also the ebooks that I have. If you become a supporter monthly at just $1 a month, which I need more and more of that, then you get both of my ebooks for free at $1 a month. And then the $2 a month, you get all of my ebooks for free, plus some exclusive content. More, as I get to over 100 patrons, I'll start adding exclusive videos and things and see how I can turn it into something more meaningful. I really need the support to keep this going, and so I really appreciate everybody who so far has supported me on Patreon, and I encourage those of you who are interested in my books or interested in keeping this show alive to go there and support at $1 a month, maybe $2 a month, as much as you can afford. I don't expect much, but maybe $1 a month, everybody can afford that. I shouldn't say everybody. If you're not able to even get the basics that you need, don't bother supporting me. I will send you my books for free for anybody who's struggling on a basic daily basis. But I, for those who do have a little bit of cushion, giving me a little bit of support would be really welcomed. That being said, let's get into the interview now with Heiko Schmidt. Hi, Heiko. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Nice to be here.
I'm glad that you decided to come and join us. I really want to talk to you about you had multiple things I want to talk to you about, but I want to start with the music industry because you are, especially in Germany, I'm sure you're an icon there, but you've made a lot of waves here. So I want to talk about that. But then you also are doing some stuff in medicine and AI. And so I want to finish out probably the second half of the interview with the really fascinating things that you're doing with medicine and AI. But first, let's get into your music industry. You You were very successful, and it ultimately turned into a 7-year legal battle with EMI and BMG, and you found international fraud and tax fraud and all sorts of things. And ultimately, you ended up winning that lawsuit and that legal case, and it changed the laws in Germany on the side of artists and producers. And I want to know what you did in the music industry, why it turned into a big lawsuit, and how it changed the laws in Germany, and whether it affected the United States, and if we still have a lot of those issues today.
Okay.
Go ahead. Start with your stuff.
A lot of questions. The good news or the bad news, whatever you want. The US is different from the legal framework here. So whatever is in the contract counts. That's good and bad at the same time. The good is if you have a good lawyer when you negotiate your contract and the lawyer put that into a contract, then you're safe and sound. If you have a beginner lawyer, or let's say not that good as a lawyer, and he doesn't, then you're screwed. So basically, that's the end of the story for the United States. How I started? Quite simple, like many people. I started as a music producer and then executive producer. We did something different in Germany because we learned that a talent and exploitation travels east. That's a rule which a lot of people don't understand, but basically it's a cultural thing. So if you're in the United States and you're a talent and you want to exploit your record, then you can do that east, which means pretty much the whole world. So if you're in Germany, you are east, it's Asia, most likely Eastern Europe, but it's not Western Europe and it's not the United States. And that is for multiple cultural reasons. And if you look into Japanese artists, they can be exploited in Japan, and that's it. So that's the long tail of the story. The reason, so we signed US talent here. We imported them into Europe and then basically produced the records over there and exploited the records all over the world. That said, is that time frame in the 90s when Eurodance were really, really big, we had 40 plus countries releasing our records. And we sold millions of records, and we also wrote or co-wrote the songs. We had publishing companies. So basically we partnered, like everyone else, with someone who has the capability to collect the money. And we are not in 40 plus countries, so there is not much of a choice you have. You have to can go with one of the big majors on each side, publishing a record side, and then you sign most likely a deal, either an administration deal or a publishing deal or a record deal. And then in that deal, actually, what you share some kind of income, and then basically that's what it is. So, but here. We did actually, and then basically I missed two-thirds of the income. So thinking in millions of dollars, two-thirds is a lot. So it was most definitely worth digging deeper, and so I did. I digged. I traveled to all the countries. Because we had success, I had local access to accountants, to people who was willing to talk, were willing to talk with me about it, and I asked the questions. And I said, "What is the price here? What is, what is the royalty rate, the usual one? What is the mechanical royalty rate, and so on and so on? And how is that accounting working? And how is money distribution working in that particular country?" So that's what I did. Hundreds of questions, and based on that, I gained a knowledge which most people don't have. If you think about it, it's a really boring issue. Who is interested in learning all that?
Well, when you're losing two-thirds of your money, you start to go on a, I don't know, you become obsessed about it, right? That's what I
Exactly.
would do. I get obsessed about some issue and I can't learn fast enough.
Exactly. And then, cut a long story short, the result was people asking me, "Okay, what is the result of two-thirds of the money losing?" And I said, "Okay, that's three major components. The one is actually human error. So if a song is identified as an example by his songwriters and the name of the songwriter. So if there's a misspelling in the registration, then the money ends up somewhere else, not at your place, somewhere else, because it cannot match in a database. So that is a human error how you lose money, and that counts for roughly one third of the income. There's another one-third of the income, basically, which is on accounting fraud, intentionally made structural accounting fraud, and that has two components. So basically, that plays into double taxation agreements or tax agreements, tax treaties between countries. So, you know, if you are, let's say you are a songwriter in Germany and or producer and artist, and then basically, you get money out of Japan, then it depends on where the headquarter of your record label or publisher is. And then basically, the majors are doing that. They have a kind of an accounting headquarter somewhere. In that case, with BMG, it was Connecticut. And they had, you know, outside of you know, was just a building. And then what they did was they did sub-licensing agreements with all the sister companies in the world and all that other record labels in the world. And then the tax treaty comes into play. So give an example, in Japan, you have a withholding tax on royalties leaving the country. So let's say, you know, in Japan, you make $100, withholding tax is 20%. So $20 usually have to stay in Japan and have to go to the Japanese tax authorities, and $80 goes further down in the licensing step. So now what they do is they account the licensing base with $80, and then they account the percentage from that. And the more steps they have and the more countries they have, they reduce the $100 to $10. So rather than you getting the $100 in Japan accounted for your income, you get $10 accounted, and then they split.
Oh, so you guys were really getting taken advantage of in that way. Now, is that still happening today to other record labels, to everybody? It just, you happen to win your lawsuit and get your money back? Did you still get your money back, or did you just win and not get it back like so many people? You know, and that happens all the time.
Yeah, it's a sad result. So I took it to the highest court in Germany, and there were three judges ruling, and they said BMG is not able to account internationally at all. So because they couldn't deliver the local numbers, they couldn't deliver anything. And it was just, you know, the accounting itself was completely flawed. Plus they added, you know, the layer of fraud. But thinking on tax fraud issues, you know, if you're a German company and you reduce the income what comes to the German parent company with a U.S. subsidy in that way, then you also commit tax fraud. Not on my end, but on their own companies. So they design, you know, I think. You know,
so they're paying 1/10 what they should be on that portion of the money coming in. So they're saving money on the tax end, and then they're also collecting 9/10 more than they should.
Exactly, because between the U.S. and most countries, in the tax treaties are really favorable. So you can account the deductions in the foreign country against your U.S. tax payment obligation. So that's what they did. They got the money back here in the United States, but they no matter what, they deducted it before. So in any way, they used the international tax treaty system in a clever way to reduce, you know, the money by factor, I would say 60% to 70% overall.
So now, is this affecting artists and producers in the United States at all, or is it mostly artists and producers from other countries that work with the U.S. companies?
Depends on with which company you're dealing is the answer, and where they have structured their collecting headquarter. That is, you have to dig deeper into it and see, you know, who it is and how they account and where the accounting central points are. It's not a simple answer, and I didn't do a deal in the last 7 or 8 years, so I cannot answer that question with a solid knowledge right now, who is doing what, how. I just don't know yet. I would have to dig deeper into it. But it also depends on, and here's the good news, it depends on the contract. So in the United States, you basically, if you have a clever lawyer and he understands that, then he can produce a language in the contract which rules that out. What in Germany was is, you know, the contract is not actually how the law works in Germany. There's a mixture between what the state and the government is saying and oftentimes overruling language in contracts, which is not possible here in the United States, at
Yeah,
least
the
not.
contract is the contract. So in Germany, laws changed then after this big lawsuit. I mean, you essentially they couldn't pay you. They don't have the money to pay you, so you won, but okay. How did you get some money from back?
No, but yeah, they couldn't account what they owe me, but yeah, there was a settlement, obviously.
Well, good. I was going to say, because if you didn't get any money back, that would be awful. I would assume they owed you millions and millions of dollars after you looked into it. Now, did that money go to a lot of the artists at the end of the day that deserved that money, or was it, I mean, was it enough? Did it filter down to a lot of people?
That means on our end, we got what we are, and we shared that with the artists participating and the songwriters and the producers in an equal way. So like our contracts were. So for us, the accounting further down from the settlement was simple, and it was, we involved lawyers on every single end to do that because it was such an outstanding event, which is unprecedented and not covered in our contract. So basically, we gave everyone a chance to have his fair share, and then we did. So we shared the settlement money on our end. So
Well,
basically,
good
what
for you, because I mean, it's really hard to win a major lawsuit like that. And laws, you actually got laws in Germany to change because it was so abusive. And because of that, are you kind of an icon over there in the music industry?
no, but
You're
it's.
modest. I know you are.
No, it's underappreciated actually because the artists and producers they are not really interested to learn all about it. It's for them, this creative people and and in their world, it's like, okay, how can I get my next song in the next TV show on the next, this is what they care about. Yeah, sure, we have to get accounted right and we have people doing that job for us, taking care and so on, but they're not really appreciated for that. But so to answer honestly, I'm not Nikon, but I changed law in a way which I would love to have, in every contract here in the United States saying, if your contract partner is not accounting you properly for the things they owe you, if they collect money on your behalf, you are able to cancel the contract at all, including all rights. And
Yeah,
that is
if
how
they're
we know.
committing fraud, then we could be able to look back at this.
Not even if they commit fraud, if they are not capable of accounting, collecting and accounting. See, if you trust someone with your creative work, right, and you trust them that they market it right, that they collect your money in other countries because you're not capable of, then you put that into a contract. If the other party is not able to do that job really well, you should be able to cancel the contract. That is just common sense. But in the music industry, it's not. In every.
You're stuck with somebody who's incompetent forever, right?
Exactly. And more importantly, your songs and your creative work is because it's in the most contracts is for lifetime work, so you're not getting out, and that should be, let's say if some lawyers are listening to what we are saying here, then maybe they put some clauses into contracts and say, okay, you know what, guys, you signed up for collecting and accounting, and if you cannot do it, we can cancel the contract at all, including all assets,
Well, that
and.
would be great. That would be it would it'll start to that would start to eliminate all the fraud that's just built in everywhere. I mean, that's what I'm on a crusade. I'm on a crusade of just making the world more ethical. You know, at least the United States. I'm trying to do that, and hopefully maybe it filters out elsewhere. But there's so much fraud, so much abuse. And so your story was amazing. I wanted to talk about that. I also like to talk about innovation and disruption and how the world can go in a better direction. And so you kind of got the two punch thing going on in this interview, but that is such a huge thing, you know. And it's one thing about incompetence, it's another thing when they're intentionally doing fraud in accounting and stealing a third of your money.
Yeah, that's so true. And that got me outraged. And people always tried, to settle me down with some checks on the on the way on that. And I said, you know what? I really want to know. I really want to know how much you owe me. And I want to dig, and I go to the highest court. I really want to know. And most people are just taking the first check offered. In all that cases, I haven't seen any case going to court, to a higher court, because of that. It's all, people are just settling before.
Well, they think they can take advantage of the people, and they can in most cases, and so they do. You need to fight back. You need to push back when you see stuff like this, because that's the only way you can keep people from committing fraud.
The good news out of it is means that, yeah, the lawsuit was a painful process. Painful because, you know, the judge actually, the really challenge was to convince the judge to continue to do so, because the judge doesn't have any fun with that kind of accounting stuff.
It's boring for everyone. The judge doesn't even like it.
Exactly. So it was, you know, to build convincing, you know, use cases and say, hey, look this song, and look what they did with here, and look how much money was produced here, and, you know, what do you feel about it if that would be your song? You know, like, you know, trying to convince, make it simple, you know. The other side made it hugely complex, and yeah, and, you know, all the excuses.
That's what they do. They make things so complex and so messed up. I mean, that's what's going on in our country with Wall Street and banking and all these things. That's why they get away with severe abuses. And so that's why I love your story. It's a good example of how you can take down that, because I could just see it now how it was so complex. And so people just want to shut their brain off and just say, okay, whatever.
Exactly. That was one thing. But the good one actually for me in my lifetime, when the lawsuit was over, I realized, and it was kind of okay, now I got the victory. So now what? I mean, I still have creative people and work to do, and, you know, but this is going to Universal or going to anyone else, it doesn't make a difference. You know, it's the system is in place everywhere. So what should I do? And then actually I developed a technology system based on all that knowledge who identifies all the fraud in every country, and then basically with their own system on top can eliminate all that issues we found. Not all, let's say 90% of it. You know, we cannot eliminate human error, but...
Human error is human error. So now, do a lot of people use this, at least international production companies and stuff, use this to help them make sure they're not in trouble?
We got a lot of clients, you know, when we started that system. We got a lot of clients within a year, you know, was just word of mouth. You know, we had 120 clients with huge catalogs and so on. And we had
pretty much every major artist internationally was part of that process.
Not everyone, but we had a few, you know, large catalogs. See, in the most cases, artists are locked with contracts for a long time with major record labels and major publishers. So basically they cannot get out even if they want to.
So the ones who could get out signed up with it, and then new ones signed up with it, and people, are they still using it and trying to get into that system?
Not anymore. You know, the whole thing has changed at the end of the day, but also the revenue streams have changed a lot.
The whole industry has changed, but it's a good example for how you stopped fraud.
Yeah, it is, and the technology has worked pretty well. So for give you one example, you know, the biggest increase in revenues we did on a 16,500 song jazz catalog, and it's a niche of course, but you know, we did 7 times the revenue. So basically we got the catalog in with the revenues, we deployed the system, and we increased revenue by 70 times.
That's amazing. I suppose your artists were just ecstatic.
I mean, absolutely. And that was, you know, the way we then here in the US tried to leverage the system in a different way by buying up catalogs and then deploy the system and then, flip it back to the market. But anyway, so this is just, you know, we did some entrepreneurial out of it, created a system which can help avoiding it. And that's the lesson out of it. That was the more fun part of it. So the lawsuit wasn't really fun. It was a pain.
Oh, it's awful. Lawsuits. I went through a lawsuit that lasted a couple of years. Oh, it was so awful. It was awful.
But, you know, the entrepreneurial part after was really fun, so I have to say.
Well, let's get into the more creative, high-tech stuff that you're doing. You're doing this medical AI face recognition to identify diseases just based on characteristics of someone's face. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The holistic approach, looking at people and in a is as old as human beings. So we have, since hundreds, since thousands of years, doctors who actually looked at their patients and said, "Okay, I see things, and I think that's this and this and this cause." So that is not really a new invention here. What new is actually that we put technology and science behind it and actually proved it. So I met a guy from Germany 2 years ago, Dirk Schneemann, and the guy is a master in the world in pedo and in psychophysiognomy. And so he, brought me to that space actually in medicine, and he said, "I can see that in the face." And I said, "Okay, let me dig into it. I have an engineering background, science background. So if someone telling me he can see that in the face, I doubt that first time." So then I digged up all the research available, and there were more than 300 clinical researchers in the world who tried to establish the correlation between facial features and, or let's say, body features you can see and some specific diseases. Most of that were flawed by either, were biased, or the sample size wasn't large enough, or some other flaws in the study. So I decided, you know what, we have to produce the evidence. I believe that there is a correlation. I strongly believe, as an entrepreneur, there is no science proof yet, but I believe it. So I started, setting up a collaboration with UCLA here in Los Angeles. And so we went in, and then basically we filmed heart patients' faces. So we went in with iPhone 6 Plus, now iPhone 7 Plus, and said to the patients, "Hey, can you, just say your name and, two words, and then basically move your head around in that way, and then we film you. And then please give us the permission to access your health record so that we can correlate what we can find in your face with the actual diagnosis." So we did. We started 2 years ago. Now we have thousands of patients, heart patients from UCLA. We annotated the pictures. If you film in HQ quality, then you get, in our case, roughly 1,200 single pictures, frame by frame, out of that video recordings per patient. And so basically, the scientists in our team, they started annotating what they can find. So we had an annotation tool, and then this and this. And so we annotated what we could find in the face, and then basically correlated that set of data with all the data in the patient file. So the diagnosis, the blood work, the treatment, the medication, everything else. And if you do that with artificial intelligence and deep learning, you find the patterns. You find the patterns you don't know. This is the one process. And the other process, we had the thesis, what was correlated exactly to what based on the Schneemann system, the guy I mentioned in the beginning. So in the beginning, we proved, his correlation. And then in the second step, we reverse engineered the process, and we deployed AI to learn about the unknown patterns. And the breakthrough was in May. This year, with large enough sample size in heart patients, so we found amazing correlations. It's like mind-blowing. I'm a little
So
bit.
what diseases are you able to identify at this point? Tell me what some of these mind-blowing things that you found.
Okay, give you one simple example. I'm a heart patient myself, so I've since many years and. Also UCLA heart patient. So basically, if you can see in my earlobe, I have a fault here in my earlobe on the left and on the right side. I'm not sure if you can see that properly, but this is one of the visual signs you can find if you have a heart disease, correlated to some of the heart diseases. To answer your question, we focused on heart patients only with the clinical trial right now, and the reason for that is we had to. Medicine is highly complex, and we know also the points for some type of cancer. We know the points of some other type of diseases because it's in the medical literature and it's in the Eastern medicine and so on and so on. So, but we started with cardiovascular diseases for a reason, because every 40 seconds in the United States, someone dies because of it. So we thought, okay, that's the largest group of people affected by it. And if we can develop a tool which can warn them years before they have symptoms. Then we can send them to a cardiologist, and the cardiologist can make a blood pressure treatment rather than a heart failure treatment. And that is so much of a difference. And so that was the idea behind it. And we went into it, we filmed it, and then we, you know, produced the visual and scientific proof of the correlations, which is amazing. So we are, I'm really proud of that part of it, because all the other 300 studies I found, they couldn't. So we are the first ones in the world to actually have a solid, scientific, unbiased proof of that correlations.
How incredible is that? So have you been able to take your stuff and help somebody with that? Do you have actual clients now that you've been able to identify and then send them on to a heart specialist of some kind?
We have something, but not based on the algorithms yet. So we know the what we call points of interest, and we have established the hard correlation between that. We had some. There's a really good part. You know, when we started, I produced a video for our website, and we hired actors to, you know, act a little, you know, thing, and then a daddy is on his old car, and it's a relationship to his son, and then all of a sudden the daddy dies because of a heart disease, and then the camera steps back, and then basically we show what the guy could do if he wouldn't have a heart disease and was treated, so he could see his son growing, he could see his son, you know, marrying, and so on and so on. And so we did, and you know, while we are shooting that, you know, Dirk said, you know, the guy, can you see that in his face here, and can you see that here, and can you see that here? The guy actually has a heart disease. Can you ask him if he knows that? So basically,
actor actually had heart disease.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I asked him, and he didn't know.
He didn't know. And then did you get him to go to the doctor and take care of it?
Yeah, he did. And he was diagnosed and then basically treated. So it was a real story out of real life. Dirk has a few others with cancer, breast cancer and so on out of Germany, which is amazing. So the system works. To get it scalable with machine vision algorithm is a different animal. And it's highly complex from the technology point of view, because first of all, you have to train machine vision algorithms to pick that up automatically. So what the human eye and the brain behind it can see is one thing, but to give that to AI and machine vision algorithm is a highly complex undertaking. And that's what we do right now. So we train machine vision algorithm to pick that up automatically in the face. That's the step we will accomplish until end of this year. And then, you know, the app will be available, and it's the first app which I call passive health screening. So passive health screening is when you don't have to think about an app anymore. So it's a completely new user interface. So you download an app, you give the app the permission one time to screen your face. That's it. And then you can forget the app. You don't even have to think about it anymore. And whenever you activate your phone, let's say to read your emails or to Facebook or whatever you do, then, you know, the algorithm, the camera automatically screens your face.
Will you be able to see nutritional deficiencies and all sorts of things? Possibly?
Actually, we diversify already. So to get the large set of data we need, we diversified from the heart clinic and the outpatient clinic into the emergency room in Los Angeles and into Santa Monica Clinic and so on. So we diversify by size to get, you know, the number of patients filmed. And if you're in an emergency room large like that in Los Angeles, in the middle of the city with the largest hospital, then you get everyone in with everything. So basically, we film everyone with everything and get access to the health record. And that is the natural diversification we have automatically, because we do exactly the same thing. We annotate what we find, and basically we correlate with the patient's health record, and then the algorithm will find the patterns. So to answer your questions, yes, we will find a lot of more stuff in the next few years, and then update the software basically with the different versions of it to get more and more and more diseases involved.
So, do you expect this to be maybe like an iPhone app or something somebody downloads and maybe pays a couple dollars a month or $5 a month and pretty much everybody has it?
That's what it is.
How do you expect this to fundamentally and ultimately change medicine?
In a very simple way, if you analyze the healthcare market in general by business, then you see two triggers how business is triggered in healthcare. The one is the fear of getting sick. So basically, you have on the left side a lot of products, which is Fitbits and Apple Watches and so on and so on, basically monitoring you somehow, and or 23andMe, and giving you some predictions about if you sometime in the future might get sick. The problem with that is it's not imminent. So the adoption rate in the market is only 1.5%. So that's the left part of the market, the fear of getting sick. The right side of the market is when you have symptoms. So when you have symptoms, you have 250,000 apps right now, believe it or not. You have the emergency doctors, you have your doctor, you have all the medicine right now to figure out what you have. But here's the game changer. What you really want is, and I call that the corridor of relevance. The corridor of relevance is between you are still healthy on the left side. That's why it's not relevant enough for you to do all the monitoring stuff. And then on the right side, where the symptoms, you have the symptoms and you try to find a solution. So there's a corridor of relevance in between. And there are some companies right now who are trying to get into that corridor of relevance, which is actually telling you before you have symptoms that you are sick, not the prediction that you will get sick. Actually, you are sick, you have to go now.
You're sick now, you just don't feel like it, and you don't want to wait any longer. And if you waited for symptoms, it could be too late, or it's a lot more expensive. It's a big problem. Or if you take it right away, then you likely can take care of it, and it's not going to be as expensive. Obviously, maintenance is the least expensive, but we sometimes slip into sickness, and then we can catch it right away.
Exactly. And that makes, there's many, many like pancreatic cancer. I'll give you one example, okay? We know that Steve Jobs had pancreatic cancer, actually. And, if you analyze the pictures from Steve Jobs over a 10-year period of time, and you deploy machine vision and machine learning algorithms, you actually find the spot where you can see pancreatic cancer. Pancreatic cancer is diagnosed stage 4 most of the time, and it's untreatable. So most likely, that's a death sentence if someone's telling you with pancreatic cancer because of that. It's diagnosed stage 4 most of the time. So
When can you diagnose that with face recognition? Could you diagnose it in stage 1?
yeah, I'm not sure about that. I cannot give you a firm answer, but much earlier, much, much earlier than stage 4.
And then is it treatable, pancreatic cancer? Is it treatable if you can find it in stage 1 or 2?
Yeah, it is.
Interesting. So, where else can this technology be used? What other areas of medicine, what other areas in the world, different industries can do you? I know you're a visionary because of all the things that you've done. Where else do you see this technology being able to take place and make a big difference?
Dirk has a different, another intelligence layer, how we call it. So basically, the medical part is an intelligence layer. So we have the technology has points of interest, and that's how we call it. Like the earlobe fold I did show you a while ago is a point of interest, and the machine vision algorithms pick that up and tell you. So because we have established the clinical evidence that this is a correlation. So that's the one technology. The other technology Dirk has, which is an interesting one, is he can extract 100 character items out of your face picture. And that is something which has a different underlying technology, psychophysiognomy, which is bringing facial features in correlation. It's not points of interest, is a different science, underlying science. I think that has a huge potential to nearly disrupt every market. And for that particular intelligence layer, we have so many people who really wants to have it. from Homeland Security to a lot of other people who wants to know more about character. How we want to bring it into the market is in a quite simple way.
So, are you going to be able to read underlying emotions? You're going to be able to read when people are lying. You're going to be able to read all these things when people can read facial features. You're going to be able to do it with software.
Yeah, it's actually it's a little bit different. So basically, everyone has talent and characters. Most of them undiscovered. So you think you are, and then the perception from others are different. And there's a middle ground where you most likely are in an objective way. And then basically, think about the world of today. Artificial intelligence will eliminate 50% of all jobs in the next 5 years. So the question is, here's my one example. The biggest occupation who will suffer are truck drivers, because in the US we have 7 million truck drivers, and autonomous driving is just a corner away, and they will just lose their jobs. So what the real question is, okay, that's sad, but where's the business opportunity? The business opportunity is to helping that 7 million people to find their undiscovered talent and bring them back into an active mode and rediscovering themselves and find something they don't even know exist yet. Right? So if you're driving 20 years a truck and you're, in a decent level educated, you still have talents which you have completely not discovered yet. You have a character, profile which could work perfectly in a team environment, but you don't know which team environment's actually looking for someone like you. You don't. Because all the matching in business is done by, expertise, by resumes, by a lot of other stuff, but not by talent and character profiling. Now, in the future, we're heading to a gig economy. We are already into a gig economy where, the job's not, be as long as it was for my parents for 20, 30 years, the same job. It's not going to happen anymore. So it's you most likely in 10 years from now will be part of a project, and then the project takes as long as the project takes, and then you're hopping to the next project. So basically, the key question is, how is matching working on a project base? And the answer is talent and character profiling, because in a project, people have to complement each other with different skill sets, with different characters, with different things, and putting that together as we speak today is impossible in a scientific way.
Well, they try to do it now with the resumes and man, it's terrible. Where they, I think it's just one big incompetent picking based on software, and you're weeding out so many great people. You're taking people based on the right catchphrases. I think it's awful right
It
now.
is. It is, and that was what impressed me so much. So Dirk in Germany, what he did the last 20 years, and he made his main income from, was the large top 100 Fortune companies in Europe, like BMW and Mercedes-Benz and Volkswagen. They came to him, because they have this, C-level candidates. They are always, trying to find new top-level personnel, and they hired headhunters for that, and said, okay, we need a new CEO or new CFO or new whatever for that and that and that daughter company, and can you help us? Here are the five candidates we have figured who perfectly fit, but now here are the face pictures. Give us a full character profile, full talent and character profile based on that face picture. And so he got the face pictures, and he did all that analytic work with 4,000 of them over 20 years, and he placed more than 300 in top-level positions based on that system. And it's an analog system, so he learned that. He
Well,
developed that
do you think that those people are happier? Is it a happier two-way thing, or is it people are going to be stereotyped to the nth degree?
It's a very relevant question you're asking, and I'm glad you did. Because that is exactly how it is. So, to give you an answer, one of the owners of these companies are billionaires, obviously, and they have sons and daughters, and always trying to get them, into the business and trying, to be the next generation business leader and all the kind of stuff. And most people don't want to because, they are not talented in that sector. They really have other talents they want to follow up, and so on and so on. So
Yeah, because I can see it being both a light and a dark. You know, technology is it brings really good things, and then there's some dark avenues that come in this, and it's every technology and where we're going, and it depends on how we use it, and we make sure that we don't. There has to always be some out clause or something so that we don't force people unexpectedly in a way. Because sometimes maybe you have some underlying passion that doesn't fit your character right now, but you could develop it.
Exactly. So our go-to-market strategy is quite simple with that. We roll it out as a learn more about yourself and your friends. So you can, make some pictures. Who doesn't want to know more about himself?
Well, so that sometimes you don't, but yeah.
You're right. So basically we give you that, and then what we do is, and here comes artificial intelligence, here's the bridge. So I promised Dirk, I convinced him actually to move full time to the United States last year. So I took him out of Germany as a super talent, and I said, okay, join me here in the US. And what I promise you is following. We will feed your knowledge you have developed into neural networks, into artificial intelligence. And then we will build feedback loops, how it called, to make it even more accurate. Because you have seen 4,000 people. This is nothing for artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence can easily see 40 million people. And building feedback loops in, makes your knowledge, your system, even more accurate in a way you couldn't do yourself. So basically, that's what we do right now. So we're feeding neural networks with what he knows, and actually building simple apps, creating feedback loop. One feedback loop is quite simple: is you think you have that type of character and you have that type of talent, but it's you. That's your self-reflection, right? Most likely not true. Most people, it's not true.
So
So
you
we.
mean you walk around thinking you're great at something and you're really not that good? It's kind of like the Happy Gilmore, where he thought he was a hockey player, but he really wasn't. He wasn't that great.
And you actually maybe you have talents you never discovered, right? So, which is could
Which
be
that's kind of a cool thing.
exactly it is. So basically, what we deliver to you is some kind of character profile, talent, undiscovered talents, and then we ask 10 of your closest friends and family if the character assessment is true or not. So basically, step by step by step, and we incentivize them to do so. So basically, you have both. You have your self-reflection if you think it's right, and then you have the 10 closest people to you who actually know you better than yourself. So then they can say, yeah, that's correct or that's not correct. So basically, that is what artificial intelligence needs as a feedback loop to actually, in over millions and millions of that analytic stuff and profiles we build over time. Making that assessment more accurate.
Well, you're an active entrepreneur and
Yes.
you're always doing, like I said, you're doing game-changing type stuff. You're out there in the forefront. You helped eliminate fraud in the music industry. You did big label stuff, and now you're doing all this stuff in the AI and medicine. What other stuff are you working on? I bet you have a couple other things in your back pocket.
Yeah, sure. So actually, there's two things. The one is I actively joined policy-making processes in AI, which is, obviously the dark or light part of that whole business. So I see both sides, and I see how governments have to work together. This is not a national thing. It's an international thing. Governments have to work together to produce some rules in AI. You can easily destroy human beings with AI. It's absolutely possible. And, like nuclear weapons and all that kind of stuff has some rules established on an international level. And thanks God, because otherwise, we wouldn't be alive. AI desperately needs it because right now it's Wild West. Everyone's doing whatever he thinks he can do.
Well, AI needs it just like human genetic modification needs that too, and it's not doesn't have that. So I'm so happy that you're involved, especially somebody who has worked so hard to eliminate fraud in the past, and has seen that. It's really great to get someone like you working on a panel like that and be on the light side of really moving AI forward because you know what it could do for you as well. I have to have you back periodically to talk about where that panel is and where internationally we're going with that, but keep going.
Yeah, so one example, just a recent one. There is a B20, and it was in Berlin, and that's for the G20, obviously, you know, where the 20 countries are coming together and the leaders. And it was a panel about AI and especially healthcare, because healthcare is becoming the largest part of our economy at all. It's relevant for every one of us. So basically, there is one thing, if you dig deeper into it, what holds the groundbreaking innovations back? And the answer on that question is the legal framework isn't there, how patient data can be used. And the reason why not is because the countries have to decide what they really want. Everyone says patient-centered care is what we want. But if it comes to legal framework, the first what you have to do as a government, and I'm too much American right now to say at least, you know, and I advocate for it. That's the only thing what a government should do. It should say that patient data belongs to the patient as a ownership, as a legal ownership. You know, the patient should own his data, right? So,
Absolutely.
and my understanding is because he has paid for it. You know, the one or the other way, he has paid for it and it belongs to his body and to himself.
Well, I
And
think
that.
ethically, it's you're born with that right, in my
Exactly.
opinion. I think it's just a human right.
And coming from the IP right world, I say, okay, there is a framework already in existence with a lot of laws in local countries and in any country. And you could easily take that IP framework and say, okay, we apply it for patient data. Because, you know, then the patient owns the data. Like if you write a song, you own the song, right? So it's in the framework, that's your work, right? And then basically you can, you know, decide if you want to exploit that work or if you want to sell it or if you want to license it or if you want to commercialize it, but it's your decision, not someone else's decision. So basically I said, okay, if you the only thing governments should do right now is declare legally that the patient should own his data in a real way. It means also commercially. So, and then that's it. That's all I want. Because with that one decision, you open up any sorts of things. I can tell you why Europe is so much behind. The European Union has a privacy law which overrules any decision an individual is doing. So if you're a patient and you say, I want to have my patient data, you know, used in that clinical trial to, you know, discover a treatment for this type of thing, it's not working because the legal law on the European Union level says it's not allowed, it violates privacy, it violates blah, 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 blah. So the researchers cannot access that because, you know, it's a violation of privacy law. In the United States, it's the opposite way. In the United States, we have a gray zone. No one has decided who owns it. So the Wild West is now coming. So everyone claims that he owns it. The hospital says, I own it because I store
Nobody
it.
owns it. I own my own data. That has to, I agree with you 100%. That's so important.
So now I was just
This is
sitting
a
with.
huge concept. Keep going.
Yeah, I was just with a huge hospital, right? And a huge hospital seeing, you know, all that groundbreaking stuff popping up right now because of AI, and they came up, oh, that's nice. We have all that data. Let's commercialize it. And I said, and then they offered me that data, and I said, okay, so we have all that patients, and we have that, blah, 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 blah. And do you want to do that? But you have to pay for the data. And I say, you cannot sell me something you don't own.
They can sell you the service of aggregating and delivering it, but they can't sell you the data.
Exactly. So that's the completely point. And then we go in deeper into quality of data and how you want to have it as a researcher. And yeah, there is a service to make and a business to do, most likely not from the hospitals, most likely from tech providers in combination with hospitals. But anyhow, the point is there is no legal framework. So, you know, the insurers claim that they own the data because they are the payers. So now the patient says, yeah, but hey, sorry, I paid for it in the first
Oh, you're
place.
gonna make me mad. This whole topic's gonna make me mad. I can totally see how it's the Wild West and everybody's taking a grab for that data, and it's like the DNA data. You know,
Exactly.
We need to really get a handle on this. I am so glad someone like you is involved in trying to make a difference.
Yeah, so on that, to finish the story, I was in Berlin, I was in Germany, and on that B20, there was, you know, the business leaders in that field, and, you know, from all over the countries, and then we had that workshops, and I simply, there were so many, you know, discussions about what can we do better in healthcare to make it more efficient and cost efficient and, you know, reachable and so on and so on. And then basically I came up with that simple thing and said, okay, the only thing we really need is a framework from the governments. We don't need that overruling like, you know, European Union is doing. We don't need that American Wild West right now because, you know, it doesn't help. Either way, it doesn't help. We need a simple framework, simple. Government should be there where the legal framework has to be done in a minimum way so that it's clear who owns what. And that's it. That's it. And everything else entrepreneurs can work out. And so basically that's, you know, that was my thesis in Berlin. And, you know, I got a lot of response on it. I'm not sure because there's so many stakeholders who make money, a lot of money with how it is.
That's the pushback. Whenever there's a ton of money being made, you're going to have problems, but it's so important getting that structure right. Whereas Europe, I could see how they're restricting the ability for entrepreneurs to get businesses going and to make money and to get things that patients want. And here we're abusing everybody. So we got to reel that in as well and make sure that the individual has some rights and for some protection. This is a very fascinating discussion. I would love to have you back. I want to also talk to you about the AI panel because all this stuff is heating up right now.
It is, yeah. So,
well, where can people get hold of you? Where can they see your work? Where can they learn more about you?
No, I mean, so I'm involved in many, many projects, but basically I have a LinkedIn profile. Actually, I have two different reasons, but people can contact me and do so all the time on LinkedIn and basically saying, okay, here I have this problem or I have this project, you can help. And I'm doing the same in the opposite way. So right now, you know, we are looking for data engineers and data scientists and so on. So I'm reaching out to a few on LinkedIn. And, you know, we're also building some expert groups as we speak, you know, with the smartest and brightest from universities and politics and lobbyists and so on. And we are forming a group of people who have the network and, let's say, the knowledge and are smart enough to hopefully make a difference. So that's the other part what I'm trying to do, collaborate with smart people who are in the same field.
Oh, that's great. Yes. Doesn't the whole world feel great or feel better when you just get smart people around you? It's like, oh, when they really, you can speak with them on your, you know, on your wavelength.
Yeah, it is inspiring, honestly. I love that part, you know, just being in a conference call and you have five or six other really, really smart dudes on the call and that you can learn from them, you know, in the call. This is amazing. You know, that drives me. It's the fun. Learning is the fun.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today and I really appreciate it. And we got to stay in touch because I know I need to have you back as all these things start to develop and heat up and become a nightmare, which they will.
Thanks a lot. It was really a pleasure being in your show. You have an amazing show. It's really, you have so good guests. I really, it's an honor to be there.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have a great week and great day.